Proverbs, reading from the first through the 21st verse, and then reading from the 32nd verse until the end of the proverb. Reading this morning from the Revised Standard Version. Does not wisdom call, does not understanding raise her voice? On the heights, beside the way, in the path, she takes her stand. Beside the gates in front of the town, at the entrance of the portals, she cries aloud. To you, O men, I call, and my cry is to the sons of men. O simple ones, learn prudence. O foolish men, pay attention. Hear, for I will speak noble things, and from my lips will come what is right. For my mouth will utter truth. Wickedness is an abomination to my lips. All the words of my mouth are righteous. There is nothing twisted nor crooked in them. They are all straight to him who understands, and right to those who find knowledge. Take my instruction instead of silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold. For wisdom is better than jewels, and all that you may desire cannot compare with her. I, wisdom, dwell in prudence, and I find knowledge and discretion. The fear of the Lord is hatred of evil. Pride and arrogance and the way of evil and perverted speech I hate. I have counsel and sound wisdom. I have insight. I have strength. By me kings reign and rulers decree what is just. By me princes rule and nobles govern the earth. I love those who love me, and those who seek me diligently find me. Riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and prosperity. My fruit is better than gold, even fine gold, and my yield better than choice silver. I walk in the way of righteousness, in the paths of justice, endowing with wealth those who love me and filling their treasuries. And then skipping to verse 32. And now, my sons, listen to me. Happy are those who keep my ways. Hear instruction and be wise and do not neglect it. Happy is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting beside my doors. For he who finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who misses me injures himself. All who hate me love death. May God add his blessings to this, the reading of his holy word. The proverb is said, he who finds wisdom finds life. But he who misses wisdom injures himself. Socrates put it in his own inimitable way when he insisted that the philosopher is a lover of wisdom and that the wise man is the virtuous man. But apparently neither the proverbist nor Socrates identified wisdom solely with the attainment of the kind of pragmatic abilities or facts that guarantee such desires as financial success or status recognition or even fitting in with the crowd. Rather, to seek wisdom to the proverbist and to Socrates was to devote one's life to attaining a knowledge of truth, righteousness, justice and mercy, and then acting truthfully, righteously, justly, and mercifully. It seems not inappropriate, then, to speak of a Socratic philosophy of education in connection with both the proverbist and Socrates. However, to speak of a Socratic philosophy of education is to speak reflectively. Unfortunately, the basic problem with arriving at such a reflective educational philosophy is that higher education as it exists today in America may well be too often governed by a highly unreflective type of philosophy. That is, what contemporary higher education sometimes presents to us is a system of educational ideals which have often been generalized into mass value judgment, without these value judgments having been reflected upon or analyzed as to their possible harmful effects. For example, ask any college class this question, as I did very recently. Why should you seek wisdom? Or to put it more pragmatically, why should you seek a higher education? And see what this class might say. They may reply, in order to learn a skill. But if they say, in order to learn a skill, they are probably not implying that it is the specialization which is so important. Much less are they implying what Socrates taught in the Republic, namely that each skill is practiced for the sake of those whom the skill serves, such as the physician or the shepherd. What the college student who gives this answer may actually be implying is rather, I must learn a skill so that I can make more money. Indeed, most college classes might say, right at the first, that the answer to this question can be phrased something like this: everybody ought to secure a higher education or to seek wisdom in order to succeed financially. But Proverbs says, my fruit is better than gold, even fine gold, and my yield is better than choice silver. Thus, one of the basic unanalyzed value judgments concerning higher education today is expressed in the sentence, everybody ought to succeed financially. You cannot succeed financially unless you are a highly specialized person with a large content of facts, society feels. Therefore, according to these particular people, educators should emphasize increasingly an intense sort of specialization to the possible exclusion of the ability to unify, to harmonize, to synthesize, to analyze, to criticize. Let it be noted in this connection that this value judgment is not so much undesirable as it is unreflective. No one with common horse sense would ever suggest that, quote, lack of money is equivalent to ultimate happiness, end quote. The analysis of common sense would be just the opposite, namely that a comfortable amount of money would aid in the creation of a comfortable life. But should such an unreflective value judgment as this be allowed full domination in higher education in man's quest for wisdom? As long as it is unanalyzed or unreflected upon, does it not create much distortion and misdirection of educational processes? Let me put this another way. When we assume that one of our supreme goals in higher education is to learn to attain wisdom in order to succeed financially, are we not automatically excluding certain other desirable educational ideals? Does this unconscious governing value judgment not exclude other unconscious value judgments which, like itself, ought to be brought to conscious light in our drive for wisdom? Let us, for purposes of analysis, pose a contrary value judgment to the assumption that everybody ought to seek wisdom or to gain a higher education in order to succeed financially. Let us say that anybody and everybody ought to secure a higher education, ought to seek wisdom in order to develop the power of honest and courageous decisiveness. Let us say that this ought to be one of the ideals of higher education. And then let us ask, does this value judgment not tend to suppress the second? Here, for example, we have an economics major. With 2 years of specialized courses in economics and backed up with 2 years of general education, embarking on his graduate education. At what point has he ever been called upon to exercise honest and courageous decisiveness about the basic economic premises practiced in the vocation which he will devote his life to? Has he ever been asked to make an honest and courageous decision about the ethical validity of the current union assumption that a supreme goal for unions ought to be less work for more pay, or about the ethical validity of the current management assumption that to survive we must construct shoddy products with built-in obsolescence? Go to a college class and ask that economics major. In most cases, his answer may well be, no, I have never been called upon in my major program to make such a decision, and I have never made it. Of course, the economics major is chosen solely as an example. Ask the history major if he has ever been called upon to make an honest and courageous decision concerning the ethical validity of frontier expansion or empire building, or the connection of capitalism with religious institutions, or of communism with a violence-oriented eschatology. And in most cases, his answer to the question will be, no, I have never been called upon to make an honest and courageous decision concerning the basic principles of historical development. Ask the language major, ask the natural science major. The answer will generally be the same. It is an almost wholly predetermined answer, predetermined by the unconscious assumption that I am not in college or graduate school to analyze, to synthesize. I am there to learn a skill in order to succeed financially and socially. I am not there to obtain wisdom, but only to get knowledge. The educational ideal of achieving the ability to make honest and courageous decisions is not the only educational goal which may be excluded by the unanalyzed but prevalent value judgment that everybody ought to succeed, be specialized by succeeding. This unconscious assumption may also exclude or suppress the desirable educational goal of becoming motivated toward artistic creativity. Only a brief glance at the genesis of world history is necessary to realize that in the largest number of instances, the artistic genius was usually unrecognized socially and unrewarded financially in his own time. Furthermore, such a glance shows that at times the artists themselves were so pressured by the need for finances that they allowed their abilities to be directed toward monetary goals, and thereby were seduced into presenting unworthy creations. William Faulkner's novel, Sanctuary, which he publicly stated was written merely to make money and later regretted having written, is merely one case in point. Artistic creativity may not be able to flourish under the yoke of the value judgment that everybody ought to succeed financially. Often, the greatest works of art have been born out of deprivation, as, for example, Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls, or Carson McCullough's The Wedding Guest. Should not then any educational system allow some stress to be placed on this value judgment, becoming motivated toward artistic creativity as well as on the ability to make honest and courageous decisions? Should not the educational system place these ideals or goals over or prior to the assumption that everybody ought to succeed financially? Thirdly, does not the value judgment that everybody ought to succeed financially possibly exclude the educational ideal of attaining excellence? Will the economics major, for example, go to work for a contracting company which cuts corners on house construction until cutting corners becomes part of the warp and woof of his own personality? Will the history major become a PhD teacher of history who is willing to swallow in toto the assumption that history is purely objective and that it can never answer the questions of wherefore and whereto? Will the English major become merely a high school promoter of grammatical analysis? Will the science major become purely a science technician, no matter how large a laboratory he heads? Will the social science major become solely a human computer, feeding his soul on numbers and spewing back endless statistics as the key to ultimate reality? Will the religion major become a sort of denominational Jacob, gaining his ecclesiastical plaudits at the expense of some poor Esau down the street whose admissions by transfer of letters this year did not add up as well as his? These questions, it seems to the lover of wisdom, cry out for answers simply because in each case they depict what may well happen. In each case, the question is a question which, to speak in the fashion of Heidegger, brings to light what has heretofore been hidden, namely, the fact that we need to attain intellectual and artistic excellence, and that the quest for wisdom involves this attainment. Purely objective history is not endued with the quality of excellence. English language and literature is more than grammatical analysis. Science must work from speculative or imaginative hypotheses if it is to work at all. Society is composed of unpredictable people, not unchanging Pythagorean units. And our task as ministers is to preach Christ crucified, not the denomination glorified, no matter how much we love the denomination. Ought not any educational system place as much value on the achievement of intellectual and artistic excellence as on financial or social success? Should any educational system, even inadvertently or accidentally, foster the unanalyzed value of "we worship thee, O God of gold, away with all the rest"? But this value judgment is not the only unconscious ideal which sometimes motivates programs in contemporary higher education. There are others just as undesirable as long as they are unanalyzed. Ask a college class, as I did recently, and see what they will say. You might get these three: everybody ought to secure a higher education or seek wisdom because everybody ought to be a good citizen. Everybody ought to secure a higher education or seek wisdom because everybody ought to be moral or religious. Everybody ought to secure a higher education or seek wisdom because everybody ought to be intellectual. Everybody ought to secure a higher education, the last one I got, because everybody ought to be happy. Now, in each case, these judgments may exclude or at least suppress other more desirable value judgments in our quest for wisdom. Let us briefly analyze a paradigm case in order to give a concrete example of what we are trying to say. The problem, for example, with the educational value judgment that, quote, everybody ought to be a good citizen, end quote, is not that it is undesirable, but that it, like the first to the effect that everybody ought to succeed financially, is often unreflected upon or unanalyzed. Let us pose an educational ideal which may well be in tension with this one and which may well be excluded if this one is left to operate without limitation. Let us say that everybody ought to secure a higher education or seek wisdom in order to achieve personal freedom. The problem which may lie in the assumption that good citizenship is equivalent to personal freedom is the problem to which Emile Durkheim often refers, namely, the idea or the concept, the fact that certain ideas in a society are tradition-oriented. Durkheim puts it like this when he says, the concept of the good citizen during any particular spatial-temporal epoch may well be molded by the tradition-directed forces of society, tradition-directed forces which may well be, according to Durkheim, both irrational and unconscious as well as primarily emotive. If Durkheim is right in this remark, and we think he is at least partly right, then the concept of the good citizen, if unreflected upon, may be wholly inimical to one of the true goals of a Socratic-oriented quest for wisdom. Was there, for example, any personal freedom in the Third Reich or in Stalin's benighted fiefdom? Furthermore, I must ask if totalitarianism is the only type of society which adheres to certain emotively predetermined concepts of what the good citizen ought to be. Has higher education within the framework of democracy perhaps missed the point when a fairly intelligent-looking senior college student remarks on national television, as one did not very long ago, that he thinks college students who stage peaceful protest against the United States involvement in Vietnam, and I quote him, should be tried for treason, end quote? Would he perhaps try the whole state legislature of Massachusetts for treason? And is he any less uneducated than various chairmen of selective service boards who immediately reclassify college students who stage peaceful nonviolent demonstrations solely on the basis of their demonstrations? Political conformism is not the only manifestation of the conflict of educational ideals where good citizenship and personal freedom are concerned. There are others, but perhaps the most obvious form of this conflict in our country is racial in nature, especially in certain sections of the country where it is assumed that supporting practices which enforce racial discrimination is synonymous with being a good citizen. How can a student be personally freed or learn to exercise honest and courageous decisiveness when his environment from birth imposes on him with an inescapable, silent social pressure the perspective that he is king of all humans because, by chance, he is a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant? In other words, when we have as a governing goal an unreflective type of good citizenship, are we sometimes guilty of holding as a teleological perspective the ideal of social conformity rather than good citizenship? We suspect that sometimes this is so. And we suspect that a mere redefinition of good citizenship is not enough. What needs to be done in this case is an actual displacement of one unreflective ideal with a more conscious and reflective ideal of personal freedom. Only in this way can man be made into a true citizen of the nation which is his and which he, as a child of his state, loves more than anything except his church or his family. The case of Socrates is very instructive here. Who were the good citizens of Athens? Socrates, who believed in the god of reason and the ideal of virtue, or his judges and executioners, who believed in the pagan gods of mythology and in the ideal of expediency? Who were the ones personally free? Socrates or his students? Socrates' students, they thought freedom was synonymous with geographical location and urged him to escape and go to another place there to live out his life. But Socrates was convinced himself that the righteous man is he who fears not death, and that the state's decision must be obeyed because, to quote Socrates, the state is the mother and nurse of all good things. Surely, history has accepted the accuracy of Socrates' famous remarks concerning good citizenship, and I quote from sections 39 and 40 of the Apology. And now, O men who have condemned me, I would fain prophesy to you, for I am about to die, and in the hour of death men are gifted with prophetic power. And I prophesy to you who are my murderers that immediately after my departure, punishment far heavier than you have inflicted on me will surely await you. Me you have killed because you wanted to escape the accuser and not to give an account of your lives. But that will not be as you suppose, far otherwise. For I say that there will be more accusers of you than there are now, accusers whom hitherto I have restrained. And as they are younger, they will be more inconsiderate with you, and you will be offended with them. If you think that by killing men you can prevent someone from censuring your evil lives, you are mistaken. That is not a way of escape which is either possible or honorable. The easiest and the noblest way is not to be disabling others, but to be improving yourselves. This is the prophecy which I utter before my departure to the judges who have condemned me. Could not Dietrich Bonhoeffer have said the same thing to the Nazis, or Bishop Lattimore and Ridley while being burned at the stake, or Servetus to Calvin? The point is that if the phrase the good citizen is being understood as equivalent solely to the phrase he who conforms, then conformity has succeeded and education has failed. After all, did not these pesky gadflies all help to stabilize the structures of personal freedom within the communal groups? Again, surely history has accepted Socrates' assumption that, contrary to the opinion of his emotionally motivated students, personal freedom is not the same as physical freedom, but that it is a much more complex and hard-won achievement which requires a cautious endeavor of reflection and pursuit after wisdom. Surely, history agrees with Socrates when he said, and I quote from the Phaedo, section 115, to close, I say, let a man be of good cheer about his soul, who having cast away the pleasures and ornaments of the body as alien to him, and working harm rather than good, has sought after the pleasures of knowledge, and has arrayed the soul not in some foreign attire, but in her own proper jewels, namely temperance and justice and courage and nobility and truth. In these jewels adorned, she is ready to go on her journey to the world below when her hour comes. Or, as the proverbist phrased it, wisdom is better than jewels, and all that you may desire cannot compare with her. Our Heavenly Father, inspire us through thy Spirit to attain wisdom. Help us learn how to make honest and courageous decisions. Help us to strive to become motivated toward artistic creativity and intellectual excellence. And help us to be good citizens in the true, deepest, reflective meaning of that word, knowing that our country is the mother and nurse of all good things. For we ask it in the name of our beloved Savior, Jesus Christ,